Ever feel like the tax system is just a big confusing mess?
Yeah, like a labyrinth designed to confuse you. I feel that.
Right. Well, today we're going to dive into some really surprising arguments about taxation. And get this, our source material is a real court case.
Oh, wow, a court case. Okay, what kind of case are we talking about?
So it involves this attorney named Tommy K. Crier, and he argued that he shouldn't have to pay income tax
Oh,
on the
wow.
money he makes from his legal practice.
Okay.
And he used this as a defense against tax evasion charges.
Wow, that's pretty bold. So, are we going to be looking at this through the lens of think and act locally for our listener?
Exactly. We're going to unpack excerpts from a legal memo that Crier filed.
Yeah.
And he starts off by citing a bunch of Supreme Court cases
Okay.
to basically say, hey, tax laws need to be crystal clear.
Makes sense.
Any ambiguity,
Yeah.
the taxpayer gets the benefit of the doubt.
Oh, so he's laying the groundwork to say that the income tax law, as it's written, doesn't apply to him. That's really interesting. It kind of makes you wonder, like, how often are confusing tax forms or instructions, more than just a headache? Like, are they actually?
Oh, yeah. It definitely makes you think.
Yeah.
And here's where it gets even more interesting. Crier points out that the Internal Revenue Code, this massive
Right.
document, doesn't actually define income.
You're kidding? The very foundation of income tax, and they don't even say what income is.
That's what Crier argues. And he
Wow.
turns to, standard dictionary definitions
Okay.
to argue that income really means a gain or a profit,
Right.
not just any revenue that you get.
Okay. Yeah. That distinction seems really key, especially when we're looking at it from that think and act locally perspective. Makes you wonder, does locally generated revenue automatically mean that's federally taxable income?
It's a great question. And that's exactly where Crier's argument takes us next. He looks at the Constitution and how it limits the federal government's power to tax. Specifically, he focuses on something called excise taxes, which are usually applied to very specific activities like manufacturing or selling certain goods.
Okay, so like if you apply that to a local level, are most local businesses really doing the kinds of things that would fall under those federal excise taxes?
That's exactly what Crier wants us to think about. He argues that, okay,
Yeah.
the income tax is technically categorized as an excise tax,
Right.
but it shouldn't apply to his legal work
Okay.
because he doesn't believe it falls into those activities, that are
Gotcha.
traditionally targeted by these taxes.
So we're starting to see this kind of conflict emerging between what the federal government wants to tax and the nature of local businesses.
Right.
It brings up this question of what are the limits when it comes to taxing income that was earned locally, especially when we're thinking about this whole think and act locally idea.
Yeah, and Crier doesn't stop there. He goes on to make an even bolder claim. He says that the right to work is a fundamental right.
Oh, wow. Like a fundamental right, like freedom of speech.
Exactly. Much like freedom of speech, and therefore it shouldn't be taxed.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Where's he getting that idea?
He cites a variety of Supreme Court rulings
Okay.
that seem to support this viewpoint. And it really gets you thinking. If the right to work, a fundamental right, should local earnings even be subject to federal income tax? Especially if those earnings come from, jobs or services that might not fall under these activities that are usually subject to those excise taxes.
Yeah, it really makes you rethink how we think about taxes, especially in that think and act locally framework. It seems like Cryer is suggesting that there really is a difference between local economic activity and what the feds can actually call taxable income.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But he takes this even further. He argues that wages themselves, they're not pure profit. They represent an exchange of something valuable.
Okay, I'm curious to hear more about that. What is he suggesting people are exchanging for their wages?
He argues that workers are basically trading their time, their effort, their skills, even a portion of their lifespan
Yeah.
for that paycheck. He even compares it to a mining company,
Oh,
depleting its ore reserves to generate profit. Think about it like, what do you spend to get your wages?
yeah.
Is it really fair to say that your entire paycheck is taxable income?
That's a really thought-provoking question. It's a very different way of looking at the value of work and what goes into earning a wage.
Exactly. And to support this, he brings up some legal precedents. He cites some Supreme Court cases like Stratton's Independence v. Halbert and Stanton v. Baltic Mining Co.
So he's looking at how mining companies are taxed
Right.
and comparing that to how individuals are taxed.
Exactly. He uses those mining cases to say that taxing 100% of somebody's wages is basically double taxation.
Okay.
You're getting taxed on the profit, and the capital, the worker's effort lifespan that was used to make that profit.
I see where he's going with this. He's arguing that part of our wages is actually just replenishing that human capital that we're using up in our work.
Exactly.
Not just pure profit.
Yeah.
And according to those mining cases, taxing the capital itself is unconstitutional.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, we should clarify that Cryer ultimately lost his case.
Okay.
But his arguments bring up some really interesting questions about what income really is and the limits of federal power when it comes to taxing locally derived wages.
Hmm.
Especially when we're thinking about think and act locally.
Hmm.
It seems like Cryer's suggesting that our whole system of taxation might need a rethink.
Yeah, it definitely challenges the way things are usually done. Cryer's case might be over, but what he's saying is still really relevant today, especially with more people working remotely and taking part in local economies in new ways.
Absolutely. We've covered a lot in this first part, but there's still more to uncover.
Mm-hmm.
We'll continue exploring Cryer's arguments and what they mean for think and act locally in the next part.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Tommy K. Cryer's arguments. We're really digging into how his case could change the way we think about taxes, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with this think and act locally perspective.
Yeah, and remember, Cryer's arguing that the feds are basically going beyond what they're allowed to do. By taxing income, they don't really have the authority to tax business.
Yeah. Especially when we're talking about income that was earned locally.
Exactly. And last time we were talking about Cryer's argument that wages are like an exchange of valuable resources,
mm-hmm.
our time, skills, lifespan, and effort.
Yeah, he had that great analogy with the mining company.
Right.
Depleting its resources.
Yeah. He was saying just like a mining company can deduct the depletion of their ore reserves from their taxes, people should be able to deduct the depletion of their lifespan.
Right.
When figuring out their taxable income.
Yeah. It really makes you think about those long work weeks in a whole new light.
Huh.
Like, are we really just trading pieces of our lives for a paycheck?
It does make you think.
Yeah.
And that takes him to his next point. He argues that if miners can get tax deductions for depleting their finite resources, shouldn't individuals be able to do the same? We're using up our limited ability to work to earn those wages, too.
So he's saying part of our income is basically going towards refilling that human capital that we're using up. Yeah. Not just going towards profit. And this is where things get really interesting. Cryer connects this back to those Supreme Court cases about mining companies and taxes. He says taxing 100% of wages is kind of like double taxation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You're getting taxed on the profit, and the capital, the worker's effort and lifespan that was used to get that profit.
So he's literally comparing the effort and time we put into our work to the physical things that a mining company takes out of the earth.
Exactly. And according to those legal precedents, the capital itself shouldn't be taxed.
That's a really interesting argument.
Mm.
But Cryer doesn't stop there. He actually takes it a step further and says that the right to work itself is a fundamental right.
Really? Like freedom of speech or religion?
Exactly. Cryer cites all these different Supreme Court rulings that seem to back up this idea of a right to work. And then he argues that taxing 100% of what someone earns is basically putting a tax on the very act of working.
Hmm.
Almost like a tax on just existing.
He's really taking this think and act locally idea to a whole new level. Like, you can't tax people just for choosing to be part of the local economy.
Exactly. And he doesn't just make this up. He points out that throughout history, the Supreme Court has consistently struck down taxes on fundamental rights like freedom of speech or religion. Cryer thinks taxing the right to work should be treated the same. So he's making a direct connection between those really basic freedoms and the right to earn a living, at least when we're talking about local economies.
Exactly. And remember, he's arguing that the income tax, if it really is an excise tax like the government claims, should only apply to very specific activities.
Right. So that brings up this really important question. Are the services that people provide in their local communities, are those really the kind of activities that the feds can tax with an excise tax? Or is Cryer right when he says it goes beyond what they're allowed to do?
It's a great question. It gets right to the core of Cryer's whole think and act locally argument. Is there actually a difference between economic activity at the national level and things that are truly local?
Right. And if there is a difference, does the federal government even have the power to impose this kind of blanket tax on money that people make from working locally?
Exactly. That's a question with huge implications for how we think about taxes, individual rights, and the whole relationship between local economies and federal power.
Cryer's arguments might not have worked in his case, but they're definitely something to think about. They make us look at what we consider income and whether our current tax system really lines up with the ideas of limited government and individual freedom, especially when we're talking about local economic activity.
It's true. We still have more to discuss from Cryer's journey through the legal system. Stay tuned for the final part.
Welcome back to our deep dive. It's amazing how much we can learn about the system just by looking at one lawyer's fight against the IRS.
It's really a fascinating case. And last time we were talking about how Cryer compares the right to work to other basic rights, like freedom of speech.
Right. He says that taxing wages is like taxing a fundamental right, and that shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah. And he brings up this important point about excise taxes. You know, the kind of tax the government says the income tax is? Well, they're usually applied to specific activities. The idea is you can avoid them if you don't do those things. Like, if there's a tax on cigarettes, you can just choose not to smoke.
But you can't really choose not to work, can you?
That's exactly Cryer's point. Everyone needs to make a living. It's not optional. So taxing wages becomes less like a targeted tax on something specific and more like a tax on just existing and being part of the economy.
So it's almost like we're being taxed for being alive and trying to earn money.
Exactly. And Cryer takes it even further. He points out that if the income tax is really a direct tax on people, not an excise tax on activities, then the Constitution says it has to be divided up among the states based on how many people live there.
And that's not how it works right now, is it?
Nope. So when you really get down to it, Cryer's argument makes us ask some big questions about the income tax. Is it a tax on things we can choose to avoid, or is it more like a direct tax on each person? And if it is direct tax on people, is it even legal the way it's set up now?
And when we think about think and act locally, it makes Cryer's arguments even more important. He's basically pointing out this tension between income made locally and the federal government's power to tax it.
He wants us to consider, do services provided locally and the wages people earn from them, do those even fall under the kinds of things the feds can tax with an excise tax? And if they don't, does the federal government even have the right to tax that money in the first place?
It's a really big question, with huge implications for local communities and the people who live and work there.
For sure. And even though Cryer lost his case, his arguments have definitely made people think. They force us to look at what we consider income and whether the way we tax people right now really matches up with limited government and individual freedom, especially when we're talking about local economies.
His case reminds us that these systems might seem huge and impossible to understand, but we can still challenge them, ask questions, and try to really grasp how they affect our lives and communities.
Exactly. And that's what Think and Act Locally is all about. Recognizing that even small actions and legal challenges can have a big impact and maybe even change the systems that shape our world.
So as we finish up this deep dive, we encourage you to keep thinking about these issues. What do you think about Cryer's arguments? Do they change how you see the tax system, especially when it comes to your own community? Thanks for joining us on this journey, and remember, there's always more to explore.